Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 233 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Doug Johnston speaks with Cherise Sewell about shifting from engineering to domestic noir via music journalism, exploring conflicted masculinity in his work, and being part of the tartan noir family of Scottish crime writers.
Doug Johnston's eighth novel, Crashland, was published by Faber & Faber in 2016. His previous book, The Jump, was shortlisted for the McIlvany Prize for Best Scottish Crime Novel. Hit and Run was selected as a prestigious Fiction Uncovered winner, and Smokeheads was nominated for the Crime Fest Last Laugh Award. Doug's short stories have appeared in various publications and anthologies. Doug was writer in residence at Strathclyde University from 2010 to 2012, and recently as part of the Arts in Business scheme at William Purvey's Funeral Directors. He has been a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at Queen Margaret University and has worked as a lecturer in creative writing. Doug has an interesting extracurricular writing life, being one of the co-founders of the Scotland Writers Football Club and playing drums in the Fun Love and Crime Writers, a crime writing supergroup featuring Val McDermott, Mark Billingham, Chris Brookmeyer, Stuart Neville and Luca Vesta. Doug began his working life with a PhD in nuclear physics and a job designing radars. He then retrained as an arts journalist and began writing crime fiction, specifically domestic noir. Doug talks about the process of writing noir in this interview and how the demands of raising a family has stimulated rather than stifled his creativity.
I was really curious about the way you represent these young men who seem to be almost aware of and kind of disappointed by the limitations of their masculinity, mm-hmm. especially in Hit and Run, the relationship with Adele, and Crashland, the femme fatale.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. In both those books, the main character are young men, and that's not been the case for all the books that I've written, but it was really interesting. Both of them play with that idea, and because I mean, at the start of both books, there's a fairly traumatic event, and they're like I think a lot of the male central characters. I've written several books with female central characters, but a lot of the male ones are kind of lost, like they don't really know where they are in the world, and they're trying to find a way through what they're doing. And they obviously, because I write kind of crime thrillers, so there's this traumatic event at the start. So it's mixed in with elements of post-traumatic stress and guilt and then wondering about their own masculinity. And with Crashland, I was really interested in, it's funny you should say femme fatales, because that's exactly what I had in mind. But I wanted to one of my favourite books of all time is Double Indemnity by James M. Cain, which is like the perfect little 100 pages of like femme fatale noir. But I wanted to try and write something that kind of bring that up to date a little bit and have a femme fatale who was kind of a 21st century real woman, but also have an air of mystery about her. So in both of those books that you mentioned, Crashland and Hit and Run, the central character, a young man, is projecting all sorts of things onto a woman that might or might not be there. I don't think in either of those books they're consciously choosing to do that. I think subconsciously they're deciding to do that because it's something to hold on to in amongst the chaos of what I'm throwing at them, if you know what I mean.
Mm. I do think they seem to be aware, especially in Hit and Run, he seemed to be aware of the fact that he was failing, almost as if he was monitoring where he was going wrong. He was choosing to do something that was going to cause him pain.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things is that people make wrong decisions all the time, and often they don't know why they make those decisions consciously. I think it's really interesting. I get quite bored by reading books where characters know their motivation all the time. That's not the real world. People do all sorts of stupid things for all sorts of crazy reasons. And part of the challenge of fiction is to write characters who act like we act in the real world, who do stupid things or are aware they're doing it but do it anyway. I mean, people, you know, have patterns, especially in relationships. People have recurring patterns where they, you know, women go for, you know, bad boys or whatever, or, you know, guys go for women who are going to be their mother or, you know, replacement and all that kind of stuff. And people, and they repeat these patterns, and quite often they're aware of doing it, but they just do it anyway because they can't see a way out of it. Or they're not aware that they're doing it. And they just are kind of following their instincts. And I think that's a really interesting thing to write about. It's very boring if someone knows why they're doing everything they're doing, I think.
And then in Gone Again, a man who finds himself without his wife.
What was interesting to me about Gone Again is it is a domestic situation. It's about a guy whose wife goes missing. But the book's not really about that. The book's about his relationship with his son as he tries to find out what's happened to his wife and how he can try and protect his son from everything that's happening around him. And that, and the kernel of that idea came from my own life, because I'm like a lot of writers, I'm a house husband, and I look after the kids and my wife in a real job, and she was always late coming home around the bypass in Edinburgh where we live. And it was when I had two kids that were really young and they were fighting and squabbling, I was trying to make the tea, and I just thought, what if she didn't come home?
You know, you're describing my life,
yeah,
to me.
I know, it's like, you know, what if she didn't come home? And then what if, you know, it's that classic what if then. So you'd phone the work and say she left at lunchtime, and then you'd phone the police and they say, well, the police aren't interested unless someone's vulnerable, you know, with mental health issues. So then what do you do? And really the crux of that whole book was about my relationship with my son and just the everyday stress of being a parent, you know, and having to deal with that stuff. But imagine it ramped up by 100 if your partner went missing and, you know, and bad things were happening. Imagine how you would make that worse, you know, at every stage.
But it's really interesting in that book that she had, that their relationship had failed in a way, that she had let him down, hadn't she?
Yeah.
But then his first instinct is to protect his son.
And the reaction to that book were quite interesting, actually, because I gave the central male character, like, anger management issues as well. You know, and that's another thing you're talking about, masculinity. That's, you know, he's, where his wife has had postnatal depression and disappeared before, so he thinks it's, but he's also got anger management issues and he's got a history of violence. And there are a couple of scenes in the book, one where he punches up a mum in the playground in front of his son, another where he actually strikes his son as well. And they were, to me, they were crucial scenes in the book, in that I want to try and take the reader as far as possible along with him, even when he's doing things that are quite obviously bad in a tiny moment, it's sort of snapping, but because of the immense pressure on him in that, in those circumstances, you could kind of argue that it might be understandable how he's behaving. But some people didn't go along with that at all. I mean, most people were fine, but, you know, you get people saying this, do you think it's clever to have a man hitting a woman, blah, 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 you know, all that sort of stuff, which is, I mean, everyone always brings their own stuff to books anyway. I used to think that was a total just blah, 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 that writers always said that, oh, it's a two-way experience and people bring their own experience to the book. But they really do, actually. People, it's really interesting, you get a real insight into readers' characters by how they respond to what you've written, actually, which is really interesting. There was another scene where someone found it really objectionable that he slept with his son in the same bed. His son's 5. And I was like, yeah. And I was like, wait, what? Why is that? Like, I slept with my kids when they're 5, 7, if they can't sleep, get into bed with us. Yeah, people have all sorts of interesting, weird moral boundaries that they don't want to go push past. We haven't talked yet about The Jump. That was a really interesting one about moral boundaries, actually, because The Jump is a book about suicide. Now, the main problem with writing about suicide in a sort of crime and thriller context is because you always get, you know, in thrillers or whatever, someone's committed suicide, but in the end it turns out they haven't really, because it's a whatever, serial killer, da-da-da, all that stuff. I didn't want to write that. To me, that's a cop-out. I wanted to write a book where people were committing suicide like they do in real life and where there wasn't any resolution, like there very often isn't in real life. But then the whole part of genre writing and crime and thriller writing is that you have to offer a kind of resolution. Usually that's what readers are expecting. So maybe stupidly I thought I'm going to try and square that circle and write this book that's going to do both these things. And actually I think that's probably it's the book I like most, actually, I think, out of all of them, because it got closest to what I was imagining before I started. But it's a hard book to read, and I used to read the opening at book events when I was promoting it, and you know, it was like sucking the air out of the room. People were like really, really responded to it quite, sometimes aggressively. It's interesting with crime and thriller stuff, that people will happily read about torture and mutilation and murder and all that stuff, but self-harm, like, people were really struggling with that concept. They didn't want to confront this, a lot of people. And one of the first events I did, the first question I got was, a man said, have you ever attempted suicide? And I said, no. And he said, what gives you the right to write about it? And I was like, well, like, at the time I gave him the sort of pat answer of, well, I think if you treat the subject matter and the characters with respect and empathy, then you can write about anything you want. But then afterwards I was thinking, you would never ask somebody, like, about, I mean, 99% of crime novels have a murder.
Mm.
It's like, have you ever committed murder? Mm. No. Well, what gives you the right to write about it? Nobody asks that. So why was he asking about this? It seemed like I couldn't own this. Like, I wasn't allowed to because I hadn't experienced it. It's really weird.
That is really weird. And I think mistaken. I really think the true gift of the writer, I suppose, is empathy, to feel it and then to recreate it.
Yeah. And you're right about the empathy thing. Like, a writer friend of mine, Kevin McNeil, always says at events, you know, being a writer is like walking about and everyone you see has a sign around their neck saying, what's it like to be me? You know, that's the empathy. It's like, it's all about putting yourself into another person's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you also get into questions about cultural appropriation, but maybe we'll not get into that. But yeah.
That's another area.
That's another area.
It's all grey areas, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I just think it's wrong to say you can't write about something if you haven't experienced it.
You know, part of the job is to make up stories. But I mean, I think the key is, like you say, is absolutely empathy. I think if you have empathy for your characters and situation and you treat them and the subject matter with respect, then you can write about anything you want.
Absolutely.
It's a general rule.
What do you think about the Tarte Noir label? I know some Scots are quite ambivalent about.
Yeah, I don't mind. It's fine. I think it's a useful way of grouping together a bunch of writers who otherwise might not have much in common. I mean, it's a very broad church. There's so many very diverse writers, like someone like Ian Rankin, who's obviously one, you know, Val McDermott, who are writing these brilliant detective books. And then you've got, I don't know, Chris Brookmeyer writing sort of slightly satirical things. And you've got, I mean, all sorts of amazing writers. I mean, the phrase came about from, apparently, I think this is true or not, that Ian Rankin was at a James Ellroy event and went up to get a book signed, and they were chatting. He was like, oh, I'm writing a Scottish, like, crime novel, whatever. And James Ellroy said, oh, like Tarte Noir, and then wrote something like, good luck with Tarte Noir in the book. So then Ian was like, oh, let's use that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is a handy way of grouping writers together. And there is a real strength in Scottish crime writing. The Bloody Scotland Festival, which is the Scottish crime writing festival, I mean, it's gone from strength to strength and become a real force, actually, and a real focus point for Scottish crime writing of all kinds. So yeah, I'm quite happy. I don't mind. I know some people are maybe a bit ambivalent about it, but I don't mind. It's an easy way. I mean, if it sells more books, you know, makes people more aware. I mean, one of the interesting things I've done recently is that Bloody Scotland Festival. They, in collaboration with Historic Scotland, they just brought out a book of short stories called Bloody Scotland, which is 12 crime writers who were asked to write a crime short story in a specific iconic location, because Historic Scotland look after all these castles and other sites. And it's selling like hotcakes because it's got, like, you know, it's got Scottish tourism all over it, you know, and they sell it in all the Historic Scotland venues, and they've sold American rights. I'm sure it'll do very well in the places where there are expats, you know, Australia and Canada and New Zealand and America. And it introduces all these new readers to a very varied bunch of crime writers.
Are there many men working in domestic noir, writing in that area?
No, there aren't many. There are some. I don't really know why that is. Are we just conforming to gender stereotype or whatever? I mean,
no, I listened to a radio programme the other day where they're talking about women and what women are doing in the area. But it's quite nice to read men writing in that area as well, because, well, for me, I think the domestic, it shouldn't be a gendered thing. And certainly writing in that area, it shouldn't be. I would be really disappointed if it was just women writing that, because then you're relegated again. It's nice to have another take on it.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not really bothered. It's like the same as like trying to get the publisher to sell the book. That's their business. I'm not really bothered about how the book is defined.
Tell me a bit about how you came to be a writer, though, because I know that you were an engineer.
Yes.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a writer? Because it seems quite incongruous, I suppose, for a man who's done nuclear physics.
I was always writing. I was always writing fiction at school. I loved that. The creative writing bit of English was my favourite bit, and I would write sort of short stories for my own amusement at school.
Doug, are you one of those people who's like good at everything?
No, at all.
But you could do science and you could do writing.
I can't draw. I'm absolutely terrible at art. I cannot draw. I get stick men. That's the basement. But yeah, no, so I was writing stories and I enjoyed English at school up to a point, and but I ended up doing physics because I was good at it and I quite enjoyed it. And so I ended up doing that at university. I was also in a band. I was a drummer around then. So I was in school bands and then uni bands when I came to Edinburgh University to study physics. And I was still writing stories, and I was kind of occasionally and sending them off whenever there was a deadline. When it was like the Scotland on Sunday used to run a short story competition, and I used to, you know,
I remember that.
Yeah, I used to panic and send one, you know, write one in a day and send it in and think, oh, that'll be great. And then, and you know, obviously never heard anything. Nothing ever got commended or published or anything. But I was still plugging away, and I had a little file of them, these things. And then I stayed on at university and did a PhD because it was easier than getting a job. They offered me a grant to stay on for 3 more years and be a student. So I did that. And then I had to get a job after that. So I got a job with Marconi, as was then, designing radars, which I hated. I absolutely hated that job. I couldn't be bothered with it at all. I just didn't care. You know, if you had to get up in the morning and, you know, get a bus across town and sit in an office with a shirt and tie on, do something that you can't be arsed about, you know. And so I found actually then that I was writing a lot. I kind of stopped writing because I didn't have the energy, the sort of psychological energy to do it. When I got in, I was just like, oh, I can't be bothered. And so I was kind of doing less and less than that. But what I was doing actually was still in bands, and I was starting running a fanzine, just kind of a daft comedy music thing that we were just, you know, we were printing, hand printing it and handing them out at gigs and pubs and stuff. And I started to do bits of music journalism, proper things. I got some things published in like musicians' magazines. There used to be all these free magazines you got in music instrument shops, you know, making music and stuff like that. And they published reviews and they paid. You know, I got 20 quid a review or something. And I got some stuff in the List magazine and a couple of things in the evening, Edinburgh Evening News. And so I thought maybe I should make a go of this, like, you know, because it's writing for a living, even though it's not writing fiction. So I quit my high-paid graduate engineering job. And became a freelance music journalist, just like that. And it was one of the best things I ever did, actually. You have these little moments in your life when you think, wow, what if I hadn't done that? You know, it's like that what-if thing, actually, in fiction. You know, if I hadn't done that, I might still be there working in that job that I fucking hated.
Mm.
But it was brilliant because even though I was much busier, because I was basically trying to hustle for work, you know, I was trying to build up a reputation and a bunch of contacts that I could make enough to actually live, which would be almost impossible now with the way journalism's gone. But back then, it was just about feasible. I was basically out all the time reviewing, interviewing bands. I started to do other things like restaurant reviews and book reviews and interview one or two authors and films, go to film reviews and stuff like that. Anything. Basically, you know, when you're a freelance arts journalist, if someone says, can you do this? The answer is always yes. You say, yes, I can do it. And then you worry about it later. And so I was doing that, but I was really busy, but I was actually found my creative mojo again. I started writing stories again. And I started working on my first novel, actually, not long after that.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. At what point did you think, oh, I really want to write a novel?
Well, yeah, it's always been bubbling away, but the first novel I wrote was The Ossians, which is about a band. It's about an unsigned band. And it's because I was in bands at the time and not very often touring, but certainly playing gigs or interviewing other bands or going to see. I mean, I was out at gigs 4 or 5 nights a week, like either reviewing or just for the fun of it or, you know, gigs I was playing at. And I knew this whole subculture of like unsigned band, you know, and I knew that, I mean, it's maybe not so much the case now, but I knew that, you know, the vast majority of the music in the charts came from that then, you know. It's like Snow Patrol and Coldplay, for example, came from that, you know, what's called the toilet circuit, because it's like every venue's like a toilet, you know. And I knew that for every Snow Patrol, there was 99 bands that didn't make it. And I was really fascinated in that world. And I wanted to kind of explore that world and display it for people and say, like, this is, you know, hundreds of people are doing this all the time just for the fucking love of it, and they might not get anywhere and that might not matter, but they're doing it anyway. And I wanted to look, because it ended up being a book about Scotland, so they tour around the Highlands and there's various, and it addresses kind of the cliches about Scottishness on the way, some of that stuff. And I didn't know anything about writing. I hadn't done a creative writing course or anything like that. There was a lot fewer of them then anyway. And I had no idea about writing a novel. I just was literally, I mean, it was quite easy because it was a tour, so like every chapter was a new gig, so they just did a gig, which meant it was actually quite boring and episodic. There wasn't much actually going, like a narrative running through it. But that came with the redrafting, I kind of got a little bit more of a sense of what to do.
So you were just feeling your way? You didn't start out with a structure?
No, I didn't really start. I mean, except for I had the tour dates. I had like a tour schedule up on the wall and I had a couple of chapters at the start where they were trying to find out.
Were you reading a lot?
Yeah, I was. I was reading loads of stuff, which was quite unusual with my friends. I didn't keep it a secret that I was writing a book, but of all my mates, hardly any of them were really, like none of them were writers and hardly any of them were readers really. So I was just reading, what was I reading? Oh, just anything I'd get my hands on really. Lots of Ian Banks. You know, he was a kind of benchmark for me at that time because I recognised the world, like, not the sci-fi stuff, but I recognised the, you know, the mainstream stuff that he was writing. I recognised the world he was writing about, you know, the Wasp Factory and the Crow Road and stuff, were, you know, very recognisably modern Scotland. And people like Irvine Welsh, when Trainspotting came out, honestly, it was a fucking game changer. It was absolutely... Because, I mean, the book came out in 93, I think. And I was like a student still then in Edinburgh. I was living in Edinburgh. I'd been in Edinburgh for 5 years at that point. And I was going out and clubbing and I was like taking drugs. And I knew people like Spud. I thankfully didn't know any Begbies really, but you knew the people to avoid in the certain pubs you were in. I knew the pubs that were going to, the clubs, the same places. So, I mean, that was an absolute, like, it was a total eye-opener. Because up until that point, I hadn't really understood that people could write about my sort of life. You know, it's a very common thing for writers to see. And I didn't see the world I was living reflected in any of the fiction I was. Even Scottish fiction, which seemed to me to be very... I mean, what I'd been exposed to was very kind of Glasgow-centric, like Alistair Gray or people like that, which I didn't really get because I hadn't lived in a city. I'd never lived in a city. I moved to Edinburgh, you know, and that was it. So that kind of small-town stuff. So Alan Warner was another one, his first book, Morven Callor.
I love that book.
Which is an absolutely brilliant book. But yeah, that Oban, it's called The Port or whatever it is, yeah, but it's very obviously Oban. I loved that because it was small-town Scottish life and I understood that whole world. I was very lucky. I had actually a really terrible English teacher, a really bad English teacher who, I mean, at school we didn't study anything that had been published like from the 20th century. Everything was like really old and I just could not get my head. I was utterly uninterested in everything we did at school. But my dad had been an English teacher. He was then a headmaster at a different school, actually. And he handed me a book of Seamus Heaney poetry instead of the war poetry I'd been doing or whatever. And I was just like, wow, is this poetry about, like, real-life stuff? And he handed me a copy of The Collected Stories of Raymond Carver, which was a total... That blew my mind. I was about 16 or 17. I was just like, it's about ordinary people. I mean, it's in America, but it's basically... It's about ordinary people going through, and they're all working class. I mean, almost everyone in these stories. I think that's one of the, that has really, although I write a very different kind of thing to Raymond Carver, like in terms of stylistically the prose, that has always stayed with me, that way of writing as cleanly and clearly and, you know, and concisely as possible. I know there's all sorts of arguments now about him and Gordon Lish's editor and, you know, who's...
I think all writers have to edit to get to that, though. Do you have to?
Yeah, I do. I'm going through the second draft of a novel at the moment and it's basically, I'm just, you know, scratching out so much of it. It's the first draft, you can't worry about that. You would never write anything if you think this has to be the perfect sentence. You never write anything. So I'm going through the second draft at the moment and just try to clean it, make it clean and clear so that it...
Cut,
yeah, mm-hmm. Less is more. And just trying to get the image of what's happening as easily as possible and sort of smoothly as possible into the reader's brain, you know, without any extraneous stuff anywhere.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
That was Doug Johnston in conversation with Cherise Saywell. You can find out more about Doug on his website at dougjohnston.com. That's Johnston ending in E. And that concludes episode 233, which was recorded by Cherise Saywell and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 234, in another instalment of our special Poetry Break series, the poets Joanne Lindberg and our host Julia Kopis discuss two classic poems by Mathilde Blind, a once celebrated, now neglected poet, scholar and intellectual. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.